Okay. Good afternoon. So first, some logistical stuff. So as you may or may not realize, the end of this course is coming up very soon. And as I mentioned briefly earlier, we're going to sort of divide the final into a take-home portion and a written portion. The written portion will be half the final time, so about the length of a normal exam, and end up counting for a little less. And we'll have a take-home portion, which is called Challenge on the Schedule. It's listed as being released Monday. I will probably get it released by Saturday. And it's due by the time of the written final. And it's probably, the format's probably gonna be complete all but two, probably all but two of seven, so five of seven. These numbers may vary depending on what my TAs say is too hard, too easy. I went to try to keep the difficulty roughly the same as has happened in previous semesters where there were five, you had to do all five, but you got 80 out of 100 for completing any three, for completing the first three, 90 out of 100 for completing the first four, and so on. So any five of seven is a bit different than that, but, and there might be more hints this semester than in prior semesters. It will be very similar format to the attack homework. So basically, we're gonna give you a program. We might give you some extra information, like some hints. In a couple cases, we'll give you the source code to the program. And you need to create a program which produces an input, which makes the program produce the you have passed this challenge output. As its last output, not as like, my name is you have passed this challenge. And you are responsible for figuring out what sort of attack applies, unlike our assignments. And so some of them will be extremely similar to prior homeworks. Like literally you can take your prior homework solution and like change two things and solve it. And I will make solutions, my solutions, to all the attack homeworks available, and you are welcome to modify and use them. So those should not be challenges. Some of them will not be similar to prior homeworks, but will be things we only discussed in lecture that you should be able to recognize. Like, you know, we never did an assignment on pointer subterfuge. We never did an assignment on buffer overflows that didn't overwrite the return address. Those are things we could do. Because part of the assignment is figuring out what sort of scenario applies, we're not going to answer questions on, do I use stack smashing here? We will answer general questions, like, you know, we won't tell you how to do stack smashing on the challenge assignment, but if you want to know how do I generally find out where the return address is relative to my buffer, we can go through other examples, or you can talk to students about other examples that aren't the assignment for that, and then apply the same thing to the assignment, which hopefully shouldn't be hard. And you can ask, you know, how to identify whether I can do pointer subterfuge. We can go through examples of how you know whether that works or not. You're not gonna tell you, you know, whether or not it applies to that, and you know, so please don't ask the TAs to do that. They won't be able to, and please do not share that between students. So that's part of what you're supposed to figure out. And when I post the assignment, there will be some write-up like this which should explain everything, including the format of your attack programs, which for this you can have C or Python, we don't anything to produce the output, and sort of all the details about file names and all the things like that. So any questions on this assignment in general? Yes.
When is it
due by? It's due by the time of the written final. So, which should be the 11th, I think. Let me, what? Yeah, yeah, so due by then. Yeah, and it should be released at the latest by Saturday. Okay. Any other questions? Yeah, and when it's released, I will have, so I will release it on Colab, not on the web, not download it from the website, so I can potentially reuse this without worrying about people shortcutting it in future semesters. And I also release reference solutions on Colab, not on the website, because I'd like to be able to not have readily downloadable full solutions to those assignments, just in case. someone wants to use them again. No question? No other questions then? Okay, so last time we were finishing up web security. And we had this sort of central problem, which mostly with our browser, that the browsers are really complicated. They do lots of stuff, and they're basically like a mini operating system. And we had issues with fooling this mini operating system into doing things that weren't intended. And one example of this was cross-site scripting, which is where we fooled websites into giving browsers code that they weren't supposed to have. This is command injection for the web, and it's kind of surprising because usually we don't think of HTML as being sort of a programming language, but it contains programming languages, and that's where we got in real trouble, that it wasn't just displaying weird stuff, it was actually getting our data off a website. And with that, we have this isolation mechanism that something like cross-site scripting is getting around, which was the same origin policy. This idea that browsers, since they're running these multiple websites, which are sort of programs, they actually want to keep them separate from each other. You have this notion that the stuff you do on Facebook doesn't automatically do things on Google. So there's this decision that everything on the same domain name is the same, as far as whether it can access anything. And we talked in particular about one thing where this policy didn't maybe do what you expected, because there's exceptions to the same origin policy. We talked about several, and probably the most subtle one was the thing which results in cross-site request forgery, and that's that we can make requests to other websites, we just can't like read the results. And if someone codes a website assuming that because they got a request, which came from a browser which sent a cookie, that the user made it, that's not true. So it's just mismatch where the website thought the user made this request, but actually just the user's browser made the request, not the user. And the fix to this was to add some extra tokens so you know that the user visited your website and did something, not went to some other website which sent a message to your website via the user's browser. So any questions on any of the things we talked about last time? Yeah. So the question is, what statelessness is? So the way websites work is that we take a URL and we send a request to it. So the statelessness is that when we send that request, inherently all that's there is the URL. So in the original version of the network protocol, HTTP, that websites used to talk to browsers, there's no notion that I visited this website before in any way. So that's the statelessness is. We aren't recording state like remembering what did I do before. Like you'd expect like local variables in a program are state. So inherently we don't have that. So that's what we mean by statelessness. So the web actually does have state, but this is sort of tacked on after the fact. And the big example is cookies. There's some other examples. But cookies are an example of added state where we've added something onto this protocol which wasn't really designed to be in there, where browsers send this extra information to add that state. But when we're starting out, there was no state, so that functionality is sort of second class, which is why there's not like a clean way of knowing where did this form get submitted from. Other questions or clarifications? Okay. So when we were finishing up last time, I was talking about one particular problem with the web, which was user tracking. And this is sort of a problem that's not something where our website is doing something the user wants to happen, which is what's happening with when we wanted to prevent cross-site request forgery. We wanted to make us authorize those requests that cross-site request forgery was having some attacker forge. Like that the user browser and the website we were talking to were in leak. And when we're talking about tracking, this is a case where we're not in together. And we mentioned that, you know, the sort of easiest strategy was either to not send cookies to other websites and hope they won't track us, So at least hope that, yeah, websites can remember what we did on their website, but hopefully they can't correlate it with everyone else, so Google doesn't learn everything you do on every single website which has a Google ad anywhere. So that was sort of the hope. And one idea was we don't never send cookies to embedded things, but that breaks a lot of websites. So sort of the more practical approach is sort of one thing is that what Firefox does is just has a blacklist, but that's very fragile. This is sort of this cat and mouse thing where like with malware definitions, we were needed to come up with a pattern for each thing, and if the people who are tracking us change how they're doing that, then it's not going to work anymore. And we need to keep updating that, and we're probably going to be perpetually behind. So there's also been attempts to use a more heuristic approach. So Privacy Badger is probably the biggest example of this, and they basically try to guess whether this looks like tracking. They look at what sort of information is in cookies, how many websites is this website included in, is it probably something I should worry about tracking? And they try to guess whether it's tracking. And this is similar to what we saw with anti-malware, where we were making heuristic guesses based on, is this binary funny? Are you making system calls that don't make sense? Things like that. Same sort of notion can apply there. And also all sorts of hard-coded exceptions to make popular websites work and things like that. So this seems like kind of viable to prevent sort of tracking, at least by blocking suspicious websites and not sending cookies. But it's actually, it's a much harder problem than that. The notion I've expressed for tracking is that Google learns what you've done because you send cookies with every Google ad and they know where the ad is displayed. That's the sort of notion about why they might learn your entire web history. And other advertising networks, which are much more obscure, don't want you to know who they are. We do that too. But there are actually other ways of tracking users. So cookies aren't the only thing you can use. So cookies are very reliable because they persist in your browser. You know it's the same browser. You know that if a user switches from the UVA network to their home network, it's still the same user, which is hard to tell. But we can still track users without cookies. And this is something that we know that many advertisers, probably not ones like Google and Facebook because they get bad publicity when they do this, but many advertisers actually do. They try to track users without using cookies. So, and it's not obvious that you can do this. So one way you can do this is with network information, IP addresses. Are you connecting from UVA? Or is it the same connection as before? So you can make guesses in that. It's less reliable, but you don't need to be 100% reliable to make this tracking be a concern to people. But there are more nefarious ways. You can just change all the URLs to have a session ID. So browser won't send cookies for you, just give them URLs which are unique for that particular user every time. It is something people did before cookies were widely supported, and you can still do it. And if you embed a page with a URL, just like we saw, you can, like the login to Facebook example, you can share information, there's no cookies involved. And more subtly than that, so adding information to URLs, like at least is pretty detectable. It's pretty obvious that that's happening because it makes the URL funny, so someone who's technically inclined might notice it. Is that you can fingerprint other aspects of the browser. So you can, in a browser, you can query lots of things about the machine you're on. You can say, what size is this screen? You want websites to know that so they can make their content fit the screen correctly. You can ask, what fonts do we have? It's good for websites to know that so they can figure out what font to use. You can figure out what plugins are installed. You can look at how do particular graphics things get rendered on this machine, which turns out to vary a little between different machines. And you have all these sort of subtle features of the machine that you can look at, and it turns out that these are often surprisingly unique. So combined with information about you're connecting from UVA, you're connecting from UVA, you have this screen resolution, you have this funny font installed that not many people have installed, you might be able to figure out exactly who someone is, even though there's no cookies involved. Which is pretty annoying for people who want to try to preserve privacy. And there's been observations of real, usually less reputable ad networks doing this sort of tracking. That people have done studies where they looked at, let's find JavaScript that does some very subtle form of tracking. Probably the most subtle one is looking for how particular like things get rendered on the screen. Like there's subtle differences between graphics cards for that. Looking for differences in that, and someone proposed this as a tracking technique. They looked for it on the web and found people were already using it to fingerprint individual users, because it varies between graphics cards. And there's also other sort of examples. One example is your browser caches things. So if you have the image for like the Facebook logo, your browser doesn't reload that every time you go to Facebook, it has a cache copy. And that's a good functionality because it makes all your websites load faster. Like remembering this, that we loaded this image before, but you can abuse this to try to see, is this the same browser I saw before based on does it try to reload this image or not? So this is a very hard problem and it's sort of an active area of research. There's many ideas about what to do about it, but I don't think there's any really good solution. Yeah. Yeah. There's not a hugely good solution. So the best solution to fingerprinting of browsers is to make all your browsers exactly the same. Which seems like a nasty thing to do, not very convenient, but this is something that, for example, Tor browser, which is the browser used with the Tor anonymization network, which tries to deal with IP addresses, tries to do. And that's sort of the best existing solution out there. So Tor, they have a networking solution, which is beyond the scope of this class to explain, to try to hide source IP addresses by tunneling traffic through third parties, basically. So you're not connecting from UVA's network, you're connecting from some random network. And they have the same browser for pretty much everybody, so the fingerprinting doesn't give you any information. Yeah. The question is, doesn't it sending it through a third party break our websites? So we aren't changing the URL, we're just forwarding the connection through a third party. So there are major security concerns with this, which are solved using cryptography, or not solved and you shouldn't do it, basically. And with Tor, because you're going through third parties you don't know, this is actually a concern, because there are actual records of people doing attacks on people who send non-encrypted traffic through Tor. Like people who apparently like automatically scan for like Bitcoin private keys and steal from them automatically. Things like that. Okay, so any other questions, concerns, comments? Oh, this issue? Yeah. So what's the problem with tracking? What are we really losing by allowing this? Why do users not like it? So this is about correlations, and this is essentially what privacy is about. So we haven't talked much about privacy in this class, which is usually a major security topic, and since it's the last class, we probably aren't going to. But privacy is all about correlating different things you do. So the concern is here that Google learns essentially every website you visit, and you know, you might not care that, you know, and maybe Google already knows that, or other ad networks too, learn every website you visit, and that correlation might be bad. There might be something embarrassing that's a website you visit, and something else that's innocent, and correlating who you are on the innocent website and who you are on the embarrassing website is bad, even if either of those in isolation is fine with you. And that's the sort of thing users are concerned about. So, you know, To give the classic example, like if you visit a website that reveals that you're gay, and you visit other websites which reveal where you work, you might not like that those two pieces of information being connected by anyone. And that's the type of concern people have. Okay, other questions? Okay, so a general note about our normal web security issues, just about tooling. So for those who here has ever written a web app of any sort as a toy or something, for class or a real one, who knows? So if you've ever done this, you've probably not actually written code which speaks HTTP directly, because that's really tedious and really easy to get wrong, but you've used one of these web frameworks. And almost all these web frameworks solve most of the problems we talked about if you use them correctly. So for example, Django is a Python framework. It defaults to adding some of the HTTP headers we talked about to say, don't embed this in a frame so you can do clickjacking. It defaults to using HTTP-only cookies, so you can't steal the cookie value from cross-site scripting if it happens. You can still do the other stuff, but you can't steal the cookie. It defaults to requiring a CSRF token for some types of requests that look like form submissions that will change things. And that's typically a thing they'll do. And for cross-site scripting, if you're using it in the way the authors intend, it will give you templates, which by default will escape HTML, do the appropriate escaping. Just like we had ways of writing SQL where we specified placeholders and that was handled correctly. So this is mostly solved, but you can still screw it up by hand. And people still do all the time. But this is one of the reasons why people want you to use these sort of frameworks that handle other issues in your web app, because they also have a convenient way of handling these security problems we talked about. You can at least make it less likely you'll have those problems. Okay. So with that cautionary note, we'll go on to a different topic briefly, which is about the browser-only side of security. So we talked about one thing, which was about how changing the browser to trust your websites less because they were concerned about things like tracking, where websites are trying to do things you don't want. And early in the semester, we talked about a more serious situation of websites trying to do things you don't want, which is where exploits are memory exploits, things like our use after free exploits, that existed in browsers. So I had this example, which was an exploit in the Chrome browser itself, since fixed, of course, where we did some complicated thing and we triggered a use after free, and this let us run arbitrary code because of this use after free bug. And browsers are sort of by accident on the forefront of dealing with things like memory exploits. Just because they're really great targets for them. Because they routinely run untrusted code is the big thing. Like, there's not any other program on your computer where you routinely take code written by someone you definitely don't trust and run it. And that's what your browser does all the time. And it needs to do that safely. And also, browsers are huge. So WebKit, which is not the JavaScript engine, just the web layout and all that stuff engine for Chrome and Safari, has a million lines of code. About a million lines. This is excluding comments and whites and blank lines. It is huge. And most of it is in C and C++. And this is typical of browsers. And so they're really concerned about exploits in browsers. And there have been widespread attacks on browsers. And in fact, there's convenient ways of getting your untrusted code to run in browsers. So like you typically think of the normal way of being that you might spend a phishing email link or something like that, but there are ways which typical users basically can't avoid. And the biggest one, sort of the most nefarious one, is malvertising, where you just buy an ad and you put malicious code in your ad. And if there's a bug in a browser, this is a great way to exploit it at scale relatively cheaply. Because you can get your ads on real websites, and you can embed, and typically what will happen is they'll embed one web page in another. So you have your own little web page running in another web page where you can put whatever JavaScript code you want. And there have been real examples of widespread exploits doing this. And it's kind of funny that advertisers would let this happen. So why would some, or not ad networks would let this happen? So why would websites sell ads and decide to let people embed something and run their own JavaScript? Yeah. So maybe to make support video. That's probably the easiest way of doing it. Just say you figure out how to play a video in a web browser. Any other ideas? Yeah. So interactive ads. So you know, you might get paid more if you allow the ads to do something interactive when you click on it. And that's going to mean code to run. Any other ideas? Yeah. Okay, so we want to choose where it goes to. Maybe you want to run code to do that. Yeah, so there's a bunch of sort of interactivity reasons. There's also some sort of back-end reasons why this happens. So the way web advertising typically works, not always, but typically works, is that web ads are often sold in real time with some sort of mini auction done by a middleman, which means that the middlemen are embedded by the publishers who don't typically have the expertise to run sort of a mini ad auction and handle all that infrastructure. So they just contract out to Google or some other provider and they actually figure out what ad do we display. And that means they're embedding something to do that. And sometimes some of the smaller operators, which aren't like Google, will contract out to other operators, and there's multiple layers. There are also major concerns about fraud in advertising. So what sort of fraud would you be worried about as an ad network? Yeah.
So like a website pretending that they were showing your ads but not actually doing it?
Yeah, so a website pretending that I have 100,000 hits and actually what they have is they have a little script that fetches their website 100,000 times. And they expect to get paid for that. So there's major concerns about something like that happening in ads. So that's another concern. So often these ad networks want to run code to make it harder to pretend to show your ad somewhere. So there's all these structural issues which encourage ad operators to do this. And also, this is where tracking happens. So ad operators really want to show the ads which are most likely to get clicks, because that's typically what they actually get paid for, not impressions. And they think that if they do tracking, they'll be able to do this better. And they need to have their own code to do their tracking. They want to embed something so they can send cookies to them and do all that, so they need that for that. So these are reasons why it turns out that typically ads embed some other web page, which means you can buy an ad and often have your own web page embedded. So from all these factors. So because of threats like this, browsers have been at the forefront of doing exploit mitigation, because they're really concerned about having attacks like this not be as big a deal. So all the major modern browser manufacturers have invested in doing every single exploit mitigation they can think of, basically, that isn't bad for performance. So browsers typically do full ASLR, their full address space randomization, they actually do that. They do regex or execute with some exceptions for runtime compiled code. And they do stack canaries and a bunch of other things. And today we're going to talk about one of the other mitigations that are sort of much more application specific that web browsers are well known for doing. And we're going to talk about this with the notion of this, of what happens when an attacker gets control of a web browser, and how could we limit that by limiting what the web browser can do? You know, so typically what one of these malvertising attacks will do is install malware. That's typically their goal. So why can code which is running for a web page, why does it even have permission to install software? You know, it shouldn't be allowed to do that. We never want to do that, is the notion. Yeah?
What about like software online?
Yeah, so there's a problem there, which is maybe sometimes we do want to do this. But our basic, our first concept is going to be, let's make that use case worse for a moment, and we'll get back to fixing it, and say, why don't we say, why don't we say, by default, we'll not allow this. And we'll run it without permissions to install new software. But yes, there's a problem that sometimes we do want it to install software. So how do we make that safe? The mechanism we have to do this is the same mechanism, which is why I can't replace BinOS on LabUnix 1. You know, I can't install my own copy of BinOS, which does who knows what, on LabUnix 1 to replace. This is the LS program. The program you run when you type LS. I can't replace that. I'm not allowed to. Permission is denied. So modern operating systems, because we have multiple users, know how to run programs with limited privileges, where you can't just install software everywhere. So why can't we usually run our browser that way? Because they already know how to enforce this, and basically what they're doing is they're saying when you say open, they just check and say no. So they have the code to do this. Why can't we reuse that to make our browser, in the typical case, not be able to do these dangerous things? And then it won't matter if someone exploits the browser, at least they can't install bad software. So you pointed out the big problem with this, which is to do this, we need to decide, okay, so we don't want browsers to be able to install software, and we ideally want to have them be able to do as little as possible. We don't want them to be other ways where they can basically take over a machine. Like, it doesn't matter if they can't install software, if they can have a program that runs forever in the background, probably. Like, that's probably about as bad. So what things should a browser be able to do? And one of them is probably that it should be able to let you install software. It probably should let you save files anywhere, which is about as bad as being able to install software, even if you can't replace system software. And it also has things like your webmail password, which for most of us is probably about as bad as installing software. Okay, so we have this idea of running the browser as a less privileged user, but for practical purposes, this doesn't work out for most users. So unless we say, I'm going to give you a browser, but you can't save files anywhere, you can't download software with it, that might be an acceptable compromise for some users, but that's not really going to work out. So this is not something browsers have implemented, but they wanted to approximate this. So their approximation is to think, remember that most of the browser doesn't need to do this. So we can't run the whole browser as a different user and have this functionality like saving files that you want. But maybe we can just run the bad parts, the parts which are doing dangerous things, like running JavaScript that we don't choose, or parsing video file formats which have 20-year-old code that no one has checked to parse the format. So we can just take the dangerous parts and run them as a less privileged user. So this notion is called privilege separation. So we're going to make one part of the browser that does things like save files, run with their permissions to do that, but we're going to make the parts which do the things that we're worried about there being exploits in run with less privileges. So when that gets exploited, the worst it can do is render the wrong image, that sort of thing. So I'm going to start with a simpler example of this, because explaining how we do this for browsers is a bit more tedious. Now let's just say we want to make video players work. We only care about showing you videos. And what's the dangerous part of sharing videos is that we take a video file that we don't trust, which might have some weird stuff in it that will break our video decoder, and that we're worried about the video decoder break. But the part where we take images from that video decoder and show them to the screen, that's pretty foolproof, we hope. You know, the images is just, you know, uncompressed images. There's nothing to mess up there. There's no parsing. We're just taking pixels, copying them to the screen. So our video decoding library, conceptually, reads a video file as input and outputs images as output. So we're just going to run a little program that just does those two tasks as a different user. And that program doesn't need to write to arbitrary files in our file system. It doesn't need to access the network, even though we might be downloading this video from a network. It doesn't need to do all these things we might be worried about an attacker wanting to do in our machine. And we're going to run it as some other user, so essentially it can't access anything important. So we're going to create a new user on our multi-user OS, so like create a new lab account on Lab Unix 1. We're going to start this video decoder program as a different user, and we're going to somehow communicate with another program. The typical mechanism is something like pipes, which are basically files that, instead of going to a file on disk, go to another program that can read and write them. So we're going to run this other program and send the video file to it and receive images to display from it. And now, if this program is exploited, the worst that can happen is we display the wrong images. Because as it's running out as another user, it can't do anything bad, we hope, assuming separating users on our OS actually works. So this idea makes sense? Questions? Yeah. So the idea of the new user is that hopefully, as a different user, I can't interfere with other users. So like if I log into Lab Unix 1, I can't just go and delete your files. I can't go and overwrite your files. And if things were set up correctly, which they usually aren't, I can't read your files. And we'll make that user have the minimum permissions on the system possible. So they hopefully can't do anything dangerous. Yeah. Yes, so this is a practical issue. So the question is, don't we need lots of permissions to create a user? Yes. You also need lots of permissions to start things as a different user often. So this is a practical issue that makes this technique harder to deploy. Is that creating a new user is a highly privileged operation, and you want to make sure you do this without making your software less secure by running things with even more privileges than they had before. So yeah, that is a practical issue. There are ways of making it work in OSs, but typically they mean that like you'd have to install this as an administrator, for example, to do this. Yeah. So our outline after this is that we have our video decoder, which switches to another user. Then we run all the dangerous decoding code, which probably has like 10 stack overflows. We don't care. And in another program, we somehow run this program and send read and write from it and display its output just as a bitmap. So this is the idea of privilege separation, the basic idea. So beyond the sort of practical difficulties of how do we actually manage to create a new user, there are some other issues with this sort of approach I've given you. So one of them is that the other user probably still has too much permissions. So if I'm on Lab Unix 1, yeah, I probably can't write over all your files, but if you accidentally left files world readable, which is a common thing, I can read them still, unless you change those permissions appropriately. And we probably want to prevent that sort of accident from happening. We want to have even less permissions than a normal other user. I can write temporary files. I can fill up your disk. It's probably not great. I can open network connections. Like, anyone can run a web browser, this other user can open random network connections. And that might be something we don't want. It can use all the memory, make the system unresponsive. So there's still things that are bad that can happen here. So we want a bit more of a complete solution. We want less privileges than a typical other user. We want some very specialized type of user which can do very little. Another issue is sort of the special permissions issue that was mentioned earlier, and just how many users do we have? So if I isolate my video decoder this way, and I'm displaying two videos, I want them to have separate video decoder users probably. I don't want those two programs interfering with each other. And do I want this for every single component? Do I create a new user? That's pretty awkward already. And we need to do this because if you're a user, you can like debug other programs you're running, which means you can pretty much do anything to them. And we don't want some one broken video to get all the information out of our other videos somehow. It's not supposed to be possible. And it's also slower. So we're doing extra copying. This is something we can mitigate by being very good at communicating between processes, but it's not trivial. Okay. So I'm going to talk about a solution to this side of things. So here, our first problem is that the other user has too many permissions. This is something that we can fix in the OS. That the OS is what's enforcing these permissions in the first place, and we just need a way to tell the OS, hey, I would like this program to be able to do even less. And it turns out that modern OSs have added functionality to do this. This did not exist historically, but because people started wanting to do this sort of privilege separation thing, they added this functionality. So on Linux, you can make this system call, and after you make it in a process, the only system calls you are allowed to make afterwards are read, write, xset, and something called sig return, which is for implementing signals so that they don't break. And read and write only work on existing open files. So you can't even open new files. You can't allocate memory, can't open network connections. So there's this nice simple mechanism which gives us everything we need to do for our video decoder. We need to read and write and xset. And all the other operations will kill the process if we try it. And since this is our only way of like accessing files, opening the network, we've actually limited the possibilities if our video decoder gets exploited. So the worst we can do after exploiting that video decoder is write data, read the data that we're decoding, which we probably already knew, and xset, and like do a bunch of computation but not send the result anywhere but in the images we're showing. Like, we can't actually do anything useful for an attacker. So this idea makes sense? Questions? And so pretty much all modern operating systems have some way of doing something like this, which has usually been added pretty recently, where you can filter what things are allowed minimally to a small list like this. And the result of doing this is often called a sandbox. The idea is that the attacker can play in the sandbox as much as they want, but it's just a sandbox. There's no way of harming anyone with the sandbox. Apparently, people who invented this term didn't think of sand in the eyes. And so this is that idea, and if you apply it to a simple case where we have a video decoder where it's straightforward what we read and write. But we want to actually do this with a web browser. We want to take the bad parts of the web browser and run them in one of these programs. And this is, in fact, the architecture of Chrome and is becoming the architecture of Firefox and then some point in the near future, and probably Edge. Like, all the major browsers are switching to this type of architecture, where basically you have two components. You have something which runs in a sandbox. Chrome calls it the rendering engine. So it handles taking the web page and the JavaScript and figuring out what to display. And it communicates with something called a browser kernel, which deals with the things which communicate with the outside world. So the browser kernel is what knows how to retrieve web pages from the network. It's what takes user mouse clicks and sends them to the rendering engine to process. And it gets out pictures to show on the screen. So this is not as simple as our video decoding example because we have more things to send than just a sequence of images. So we have this sort of mini command language that we speak to and from this rendering engine. And the idea is that we've chosen that command language. So just like when we limited our system calls to read and write, that these commands only allow things that the website is allowed to do anyways. And so that means that our attacker, when they exploit this rendering engine, they don't get anything useful. Yeah, they're running code faster than they were in JavaScript, but that's about it. They can still only display things on the current website and process clicks to the current website and send networking connections that they would already be allowed to do. So there's no danger in allowing this. Yeah.
This kind of architecture takes up more like system resources, because as we know, like Chrome is known for eating a lot of memory.
So question is, doesn't this architecture take more resources? Yes. So yes, it does. At the least, we need to send stuff back and forth, so we might have extra copies of things. We have more processes, and those take up a certain resources, so we like have two copies of parts of libraries loaded, probably. So yes, it takes up some more resources. And that's sort of the compromise we're making by choosing this separated architecture. And so the idea is that, as I said, there's this command language. So in the original Chrome interface, we have commands which are sent in both directions, from the sandbox to the browser kernel and back. So the browser kernel to the sandbox sends user input, and also, I forgot the important one, sends network information, sends outside network input. And the browser kernel can say, here's an image I want you to show on the screen. And this is implemented very efficiently with shared memory, so it's not actually that slow or inefficient, but because that's important. You can say, make a request for this URL, in which case they'll get back the data from that URL. You can say, download this file to the local file system, so that seems a bit dangerous. We'll talk about that. And upload a file the user requested. Because, you know, like in Archimedes, you can upload a file, so we need to actually support that. So this make a request for this URL, it has some filtering. So at least we can allow file URLs. So the browser kernel, when it looks at this command, it can say, apply a policy. And this is a common thing you'll see these privilege separated architectures do, that will allow certain commands and will have a policy to make our security work. But just filtering out file URLs isn't quite enough, because we can still read any website with the original architecture. And this was a problem with the original architecture. So we can read any website, but at least we can't write to the local file system. Now here, we can download files to the local file system, but they go to the download directory the user specifies only. So that's how we make this safe. So the browser kernel chooses where they go, the rendering sandbox does not. So we've got them do a safe version of the write a file operation, or safer at least, rather than just letting them write anything, anywhere. And so the user has to choose through the browser kernel where to put the file. The sandbox doesn't get to decide. And for uploading files, similarly, the browser kernel displays an upload dialog box. The sandbox thing doesn't get to decide what file gets uploaded. And it doesn't get to display the user interface for choosing that file. So there's this user interface for uploading a file is run in trusted software, so you know that it's actually respecting your choice. And that's, you know, uploading is handled by the trusted part, not the sandbox part. So if someone exploits the sandbox, they can't choose a different file to upload. Yeah?
You mentioned that
the question is, if we're filtering out file URLs, how do we actually be able to browse to file URLs? So Chrome's solution to this is that if you want to do that, they make a request to the browser kernel to please replace me with a different sandbox. And it will start a new sandbox that's different, that's allowed to browse file URLs. but it's different than the sandbox used to render normal web pages. So that's how they provide that isolation. But we have this similar problem here where we can request other URLs which we aren't supposed to get access to. So if you remember the same origin policy, we're still enforcing the same origin policy in this sandbox code, which means that if someone exploits the sandbox, they can break it. They can read websites that are supposed to be private even after having cookies set. And this is difficult to fix because of iframes, because of embedding websites in other websites. So in order to fix it, we need to not have them, we need to have this show this image on the screen thing merge things from two different sandboxes, which was not something that Chrome has implemented in early versions. So they almost have a process per site, but they don't respect same origin because of embedding things in other websites. And they're working on fixing this, but it's difficult to implement because they need to have part of the website rendered in one sandbox and part in another, and have that merged together appropriately. And since you saw that, we can like have part embed a website in another website and have it be transparent or translucent, that's really annoying to do. So there's this idea of what this sandbox is doing makes sense. So a tricky thing and a question that you might have when you look at any architecture that looks like this. So this is a common proposal when people want to make secure systems, so that you divide it up into the dangerous part and the part which does the sensitive operations, and you hope they're different. Is that how do we make the part which does the sensitive operations, which Chrome calls the browser kernel, secure? So it's not simple. It's several hundred thousand lines of code still. And it needs to securely implement this special protocol. Like if it messes up how it handles, please get this URL for me, or please display this for me, we're in trouble. And that's a completely new protocol that we need to worry about testing and making sure that there's nothing malicious that we can send that will misinterpret. Like if we have lengths, we need to make sure we aren't having buffer overflows in the browser kernel. And we've also made the code more complicated overall. So our UI code now has this extra layer of indirection where we have to send every user input through into a command and try to translate it back. So you've also made things more complicated, possibly less secure, and definitely a little slow. But the hope is that writing the secure browser kernel, even with this sort of extra complication, is easier than writing a whole secure browser. That's the hope. And this is a general technique. So I'm talking about it in browsers because this is the most prominent place where it is used. But this idea of separating our two parts of software is something you can use in lots of large software systems where you're worried about some part being exploitable. And it's a very effective mitigation because it is actually hard to get around. It's not one of these things like, write X or execute where we have this sort of generic workaround. Getting around these sandboxes really is a problem for attackers. It makes many real exploits be much less bad. Just because you can't like write files in the local file system willy-nilly. So to give another example of where this is used, probably the most prominent example in the academic literature before browsers of this technique was OpenSSH. So OpenSSH is the most popular SSH server and client, and the OpenSSH server has used privilege separation for a while. And they used it back in the days when it was really awkward, when there was nothing like that convenient system call to say don't only allow reads and writes. So they actually did it by creating a new user, by using something called chroot to limit what files that the process could access, and a whole bunch of other weird things that are annoying to do at the time, rather than having a nice convenient mechanism saying just don't allow me to make any system calls, please. And they did this to separate the network processing code from the authentication code. So they have a sandbox process that runs when you connect to the SSH server but haven't logged in yet, because that's what they're most concerned about. And it can say, hey, I'd like you to perform a cryptographic operation with the long-term secret key of the server. So you have an SSH key for the server. That's not supposed to be leaked, otherwise you can pretend to be the server. So the sandbox process can have this performed on its behalf, but it doesn't actually get this key material that would let it do it repeatedly. So it only gets to do it while it's running. So it can't send that material off. And it can say, hey, I'd like to authenticate. Here's the password I got. Please switch over my connection to something running as that user. And we don't actually give the functionality to switch to an arbitrary user to the sandbox thing, which handles like reading from our network. We just let it send this command where if the password is right, our monitor will say, kill this sandbox process and start a new one, start a new process as the user that they authenticated as. And so in that way, we avoid exposing this really high privilege operation of run something as any user by making sure that we have a simple API that's not as complicated as our network connection, and we check the passwords to allow it. And unlike Chrome, OpenSSH added this privilege separation after the fact. So we can look at how complicated it made things. Does anyone have guesses as to what you have to add to do this? So what's one thing we need to add to this code? Yeah, do this. What do we need to change in the original code before we had this all happening in one process? Yeah, so we have to add a whole bunch of process management code. So that's code we never wrote before, so completely new code. We also need to write code which, when we tell the monitor to do things, we have to invent this command language. We have to write the code which parses that and writes messages in that. So it's actually a substantial amount of code. And since OpenSSH added it after the fact, which is not how Chrome worked, Chrome started with this design. So they know what their changes were. So they added about 3,000 lines to implement the communication protocols and the starting processes and all that. And about 2% of the other code, about 950 lines, they said they needed to change to, instead of calling a function directly, to send a message over this, over the connection to the monitor or to the sandbox. So overall, this means they changed about 8% worth of their code. And to do this, this wasn't trivial. So they need to really, they need to think about, you know, why this boundary? They need to think about what operations can we move to the monitor versus not. And this is not an obvious boundary. And it's much less clear than the browser case that this is really useful, because we have some pretty complicated things we're allowing across. We're allowing the sandbox to ask for. It also makes it less clear that we're actually separating the code, the dangerous code from the non-dangerous code. Like, are these operations we're asking to do actually something we're likely to screw up and have a security vulnerability in? They had some convincing reasons to believe that it would be less likely, but you know, that's certainly not a guarantee. I think when they were done, they said about 66% of the code ran in the sandbox, around 33% ran outside. One argument for this, though, is that maybe if you're doing this, it's a better application design anyways, if you're separating your system into these components. But it's not free. You can add it onto an existing application. It's not that much work, and maybe it's worth the security, but it's not trivial. It's easier than it used to be. Because when they implemented this, this was basically the first time anyone was doing this. Not quite the first time, but almost. Like maybe one or two major software projects have done it before. But this is a general technique that if you design a large piece of software that you'd like to do, probably, because you know, it does actually prevent lots of exploits. It's very hard to think of a way out of this, assuming that we don't mess up the implementation of these commands, which is less to check than our general network protocol, we hope. Okay. So any questions about privilege separation in general? Comments? So I'd like to talk a bit about sort of our first approach. So I started out by saying we couldn't confine whole browsers, like because we trusted them to do too many things. That we had this problem that, yeah, you can install software in your browser. And that's something that we want browsers to be able to do. And, you know, can we just, you know, and we can't really do that because there's too much that the application can do. So we need application changes to separate out the dangerous and non-dangerous parts. But maybe for some simpler applications, we cannot modify the application and just tell the OS, here are the things this application is supposed to be able to do, and only let it do it. And this is a common idea. This is sandboxing applications, sometimes known as application confinement, where we just say, here are the things it can request of you, don't allow anything else. And this is a common idea and a good idea, but modern OSs make it pretty hard. So for example, let's go to our media player example. So maybe we can't do the privilege separation thing because that involves modifying our media player a lot. Maybe we just want to take an existing media player and run it without being able to like write to random files in my file system that I didn't request. I just say what file I'm opening and we can maybe only let it open that, and that's good. And it would seem straightforward that we can say, okay, only allow reading that file and writing to the screen. That's what you'd think. But the problem is the program asks for a few more things. Can anyone think of some other things that the program might need to do? Right, run a media player on a local file. What does I need to allow it to do besides read that file and write to the output which goes to the screen? Yeah. So it needs to decode media?
Yeah, so you have different formats.
Okay.
It doesn't know what type it is, so it has to call a different decoder.
Okay, so it has to load some library to decode the file. So we have some libraries it needs to load. Anything else we might need to access? Yeah.
So I might need to open some media player.
So this is our media player we're opening. Sorry, yeah. So, yeah.
There's network media players too, so like VLC.
Okay, yeah. So maybe the file we're loading isn't a local file, but a network, and we need to somehow say what that is. Okay. And yeah, so there's these other things we didn't think of, and there's a lot more than you would think. So as an experiment, I'd ran VLC, playing a local file on my laptop, and recorded all the system calls it made. It used 73 unique system calls. So you would think like open, read, write, but no, there's 73 unique ones. Allocate memory, but yeah, it's a lot. So these are all basically in the same sorts of categories, but this is hard to enumerate. This is the main practical reason why we don't do this all the time. That figuring out what are these system calls is not trivial. They're all like, things which are probably obviously allowed. And it also opens lots of files that aren't the video file. So we talked about libraries for decoding things. It also loads fonts, because it displays text. It loads configuration files. It loads files which contain translations of all its messages. So if we wanted to apply this system call filtering technique, we need to somehow come up with a filter which includes all of these, which is doable. One way of doing it is you run the program and you hope you've seen all the files it actually needs to access legitimately, and you set that as a filter. But this is not trivial to do in a way where you're sure you didn't miss something, like maybe only sometimes it accesses a certain font. And if you don't have that on your list, oops. Now you've broken the program by trying to keep it from doing dangerous things. So this is a reason why we don't just do this transparently. It's actually hard to figure out what the program needs to be allowed to do. Just because the interface of the system call is pretty complicated. And because programs are maybe more complicated than they seem. Or at least ones like VLC, which you know have existed for 10 years and have lots of little features that are rarely used, but mean that they have configuration files and things like that. So, but this is an idea people have had, and it's something you can actually do. The problem is that you need to actually figure out what system calls to allow, what arguments to the system calls to allow, which is hard to enumerate. So, probably the most successful implementation of this sort of strategy is on OS X. So OS X implements actual system call filtering, especially for App Store apps in recent versions. And part of the reason they can get away with this is that they say if you want your app on the Mac App Store, you need to have it run in this sandbox with system calls filtered out. So you need to make sure that you know what system calls you need, and it's only the permitted set. You need to know what files you need to access, and they should all be ones that are correctly enumerated in your application so it can run correctly. And the main challenge here is how do we usefully do this for files? So when I was talking about running my media player, I knew what file I was running it on, but usually you like expect to open a file rather than know what file it needs to run on so you can set up this filter appropriately. Can anyone think of, so we saw a technique with browsers. What was that? What would we do for the browser isolation when you're worried about accessing local files? Yeah?
So you just have one file manager that other things can call and you select the file.
Yeah. So the idea that OXX uses to solve this is that there's an OS service that displays file open dialogs. Applications don't display their own file open dialog boxes. They ask an OS service to do it for them. And this OS service is trusted, and it remembers what file the user actually chose and uses that as a note to say, this application now has permission to read and write that file. And the application can also ask to remember, oh, you chose this file previously, so next time you open me, please also open it. But based on the fact that the user chose it at some time. And so this is how you can practically implement that sort of isolation. So you first need to, like, the first part of the solution was to get rid of all the sort of operations you can do by making sure that the application developer is responsible for knowing what things they need to access, because they know they need to run in the sandbox, and having this trusted way where users can say, what files do I want this application to access, rather than letting them scribble over every single file anywhere. So any questions about this sort of approach? And here, so this is sort of what many operating systems are trying to move to. It's tricky because you need application developer buy-in to get the app, make this actually beneficial. Like you need to have not only them buy in and you know make sure that they make their applications work with this filtering, you need some mechanism like this where you can have trusted ways of having users specify things like files so the filters aren't meaningless. So like a filter which says you can open any file I can read or write is not useful. You don't want random game to be able to write over all your files just because it has a save game functionality. So this is probably the most widely deployed sort of this isolation beyond sort of browsers, which do it just for the browser and have this application-specific implementation. This is sort of making it work for every application. But it still requires some application buy-in because the applications need to know that they're working with this and that they can't do things like put preference files outside designated locations. It just won't work. So there's another technique for isolating applications from each other, and that's sort of a more classic and more heavyweight one. So beyond isolating applications with by filtering out system calls. We talked about one other technique in this class for isolating programs. Anyone remember what that was? Had an assignment on it. That was the easiest assignment in the class, I hope. Yeah.
Running it in a VM.
Yeah, so running it in a VM. And this is something that is another proposal for isolating applications. And probably the most prominent implementation is something called kubes, which basically, the idea is that it's an OS where it just runs everything in separate VMs. You have a VM per task. So the idea is like you have a VM for your work stuff and a VM for your game stuff. And it runs separate VMs with a full OS and just displays them all on one screen with a UI that tells you what VM does each thing come from. So this is a screenshot which gives a better example. So what kubes does is it outlines all the windows for each VM in the color, indicating what VM it's from. So you know that things in this blue window can't interfere with things in this red window, because they're different VMs. They're actually isolated, and they have some user interface mechanisms for copying files between the VMs in a trusted user interface. Yeah.
So do they work like regular VMs, and you can run like whatever file format they use, even though that you're because they use that file format?
Yeah. So these are real VMs with all the advantages and disadvantages that has. So the disadvantage is that this is way more resource intensive than our privilege separation. The big advantage is that you can be much more confident of the isolation. So system call filtering doesn't have the greatest history for bugs. So I've mentioned before that there have been bugs in VM isolation where you could escape VMs. Those have been pretty uncommon, especially with hardware support. Bugs in system call isolation have been much more common. And a typical way this happens is if some system calls have bugs in their implementation that might allow you to escape. And there's, like, as I said, even my simple media player playing a local file calls like 80 system calls. Yeah, there's lots of code there in the OS which could be buggy. And all that needs to be correct if you're allowing each of those system calls through the filter. And if you need to allow like 80 or 100 system calls, you're likely to make some mistakes or miss some bugs in the OS which allow the attacker to get out of your sandbox. So the history has not been as great as for VMs. VMs, there have been VM escapes, but they're like very uncommon, and they're often situational. But there have been like kernel bugs in Linux, for example, with system calls you can't filter easily. For example, the futex system call, which is used to implement synchronization between threads, which often is needed by some a renderer process to use shared memory, has had bugs in the past which allow you to escape sandboxes. But this is sort of probably the best existing solution if you want to run applications in a real user interface that you can actually use and have them be isolated from each other in a convincing way as a normal user without changing those applications to play better with this system. So next time I'm going to be talking about here's my window. Okay. About the final exam review. So bring all your questions, or else it will be a very short class. For the final, I intend to, for the written part of the final, mostly cover stuff after the last midterm, like 60%. And I tend to try to focus on things that aren't covered in the challenge assignments. Yeah.
What's like the time frame for the challenge assignments? When is it released?
So I intend to release it by end of day Saturday, probably maybe by end of day Friday, and it will be due before the written part of the final is taken.
Are we allowed to ask questions about it in office hours?
I have my slide for that. You can ask questions about general strategies, but not specific challenges. So we will gladly go over how do I know whether I can use stack smashing or not, Or how do I do stack smashing on some other example? We're gladly over that. We're not going to answer questions about the specific challenges, and you should not discuss with other students things about the specific challenges, but you're welcome to discuss generally like the various techniques. Yeah. It will be less because it should be I expect to do 90 minutes. I will aim to have a similar length to our midterms for the written part of the final. So other questions? Before we move on. Okay. Yeah. Are you allowed to use the internet for the challenge? Yeah, you can look things up as long as it's about general strategies. Like, do not post on Stack Overflow with the challenge, please. And if you're taking code or anything like that, I expect it to be cited in your solution.